So, when you're comfortable, I shall begin. Number one, looking at people's good qualities is great advice, Ajahn. Wow, whoever wrote that is really a great Christian person. And look at your good qualities. Looking at people's good qualities is great advice, Ajahn. It's like a circuit breaker for Papancha. Papancha is conceptual proliferation. Am I thinking? The ego can't complain and therefore exists. This softens the mind up too. Is it better for our practice towards cessation to look at positive qualities and train in that rather than being indifferent? How should we train in this? Brilliant. Absolutely. If you look at the positive qualities, number one, it gives you inspiration and energy. And number two, when you train in that, it has a great advantage when you get to nimitta stage of meditation. Because straight away, you know, when a nimitta comes up, you look for the positive qualities in it. Not the defects in it, but the beautiful qualities in it. Because sometimes people see these beautiful lights and, you know, sometimes it's dull, it's not brilliant enough to take you into jhanas. But if you've got a positive mind, you look in that nimitta and you find the most positive part of that nimitta, the most beautiful part. You just incline that way because that's what you've been doing. If you do that, the nimitta will brighten up and you really have a wonderful time. I remember many, many years ago, first time I went to visit England, and Ajahn Sumedho took me on this, he was doing a little Dharma tour, and we went to the town of Doncaster on the weekend to teach a weekend meditation retreat. And as soon as we got there, the people in Doncaster, this is really weird. Usually on a weekend, everybody leaves Doncaster, and you guys actually come here, because it was like a coal town, and it wasn't a very pretty town. But early in the morning, we went for a walk, and that just made us a positive character. I'm a positive character. So, you know, we went, you know, walked by the park and in the flower gardens and even saw a nice church and had a squiz inside. And when we came back, they asked, where did you work? And we said, well, we walked to the gardens and the park. And actually, that was where when somebody came up in Doncaster, Rajan Sumedho, and said, you're dressed like Superman. But anyway, when we got back, we told him where we'd gone. He said, that was really interesting, because there was another monk who went there a couple of months before. And when he went for a walk, he went to the gas works and the industrial area. And he said, there's a lot of sort of psychology in that. You two guys are so positive. That guy's very negative. And so just the way you incline, where you actually go walking to, you know, where your mind goes to. If you develop a positive mind, always seeing the positive qualities in other people, you see it in yourself, you see it in your meditation, and you're away. It's called the developing of the subanimitta, the beautiful perceptions. So, and of course, if you see the good qualities in people, you've got nothing to argue with them about. See the beautiful qualities in the food, then you've got nothing to argue about. See the beautiful qualities in your bed, you've got nothing to argue about. So it's wonderful when you say, have no negativity. It's just, you're peaceful. Because negativity means you've got business. Something to do. That's why actually people like negativity. It gives them something to do in life. Ajahn. This is a great question for the evening. Are you ready for this question? Ajahn, is there a difference between love and sex? I found my wife having sex with another man. What should I do? Look at people's good qualities. Your wife must be happy. So isn't your wife's happiness the most important thing in the world for her? She's having a wonderful time. Oh, good on you, wife. Gets you out of having to do anything. Okay, that's a silly. But please keep the questions to meditation. So, can we pass on that one? Yeah, I'll pass on that one. So what you do, if you find your wife having sex with another man, obviously the thing to do is obviously she's broken the precepts and she's broken your trust. So, you know, you just got to really sort of sit down and talk, you know, do you really want this relationship to continue on?
You've got to really find out just whether, you know, the relationship is dead and gone, or whether she really does, you know, had a sort of a momentary lapse of what she really wants to do in life. And if the case is that yes, you know, she sort of really, you know, is regretful, and she wishes she hadn't done it because, you know, just the lust got into her mind and she decided to do that, then forgive her. Because we should always forgive, if at all possible. And actually I just got a letter this evening. You know, I just went over to the monasteries. I do every evening after about 5 o'clock, have a shower, check in with the monastery, and there was a couple of letters there. One was from this fellow, and his wife has committed adultery twice. And the first time they came to me for counselling, I really talked to them, you know, gave her the stories from the opening the door of your heart. And it seemed to sort of work. They got together again, and they actually had another reaffirmation of their vows down at Bodhinyana Monastery with me, because I got their marriage together. And then recently, that was many years ago, recently happened again. So I came to advice a second time. And I said, well, you know, in my story, there were two bad bricks in the wall. So number one a few years ago, this is number two. So give her another chance, which she has. And so they're back together again. It seems it's working out. And so, you know, it was, you know, give some forgiveness if at all possible. But also with that forgiveness, there has to be commitment on the offending partner to really restrain themselves and also to get some strategies up. Because obviously that they have a tendency towards attraction to people other than their partner. So they know that's a danger. Twice they've been caught. Now, forgiveness is okay, but you need to have something more positive than that. Now, for the girl, if you find sort of a guy you really like in the office or at work or something, now what are you going to do next time? You know, you have to sort of learn how to walk away or call me and talk it over or do something. Find some strategies, because otherwise you're going to get caught again. So it's, you know, the forgiveness is there, but it's not just forgiveness. Oh, okay, I forgive you. Because there's a danger that you want to make sure it does not happen again. And that's where you have to work it out, work out some strategies, so when you get close to that again, you know, you don't sort of go down that path ever again. And it's just like that simile of the snake which I sort of gave the other day. That's your danger. You realize that's a danger that's really wrecking your life. So, you know, if you start getting any lust, the first bit of lust which comes up, notice it quickly, because that's a danger, and then you can always take another route so you don't break your trust, you know, in a marriage. Interesting question. Dear Ajahn, I still don't get the concept of no free will at all. Please explain.
No.
Can I do that tomorrow? Because I'm going to be talking about insight tomorrow. After focusing on the breath, there comes a strong stillness. It's like I've become a rock, frozen. With this comes a surge of energy, and I start to feel it strained or forced. So I relax, but then I'm back to the breath. It doesn't feel like the center of the breath, but another awareness. Should I follow this or return to the breath? I wouldn't actually choose. I've given this advice to quite a few people on this retreat. When you get to these interesting stages of meditation, it's as if that you don't do any driving anymore. You're not the sort of the pilot of your aircraft. You become the passenger. So you just sit back and see what the mind wants to do. And if the mind wants to sort of go into that strong stillness, so you become rocks and you get a large surge of energy, then just let it go. If you feel it's strained, it's not your business. The mind will sort of settle things out. So when you really make peace, be kind, be gentle, you can't go wrong in meditation. Because it's right intention. So, you know, if they have that strong stillness, make peace with it. Don't disturb it. Don't fight it. Don't encourage it. Just be kind to it. Open the door of your heart to that strong stillness. Be very gentle with it. And that's the best you can do. And then see what happens. You know, if it's the right time, that stillness will get deeper and deeper and be much more peaceful. If it's not the right time, your mind will go back onto the breath. It's just natural. Nothing to do with you. So that's the instructions. Dear Ajahn, what's going on here? Dear Ajahn Brahm, does sex hinder the progress of meditation? I think you get to that stage of this retreat, you're getting bored. Yeah, all these questions. Crazy, isn't it? Does sex hinder the progress of meditation? I don't think you can be all that one-pointed on your breath while you're having sex. And also, if you have sex, make sure you make peace. You'll go into your chest. But then you don't, it all takes all the fun away from it. So you just, hey, what are you asking me for? I've had sex for 40 years. Both 35, 36, 37, about 37 years. Make, oh great, at last, not a sex question. Making peace, being kind and gentle, that's not allowing the sense of self to express itself, right? Brilliant, well done, great insight. So it's subdividing, or subduing, craving, ego, not making more samsara. Is this framework understanding correct? Exactly, that's why it's hard to do. To make peace and be kind, be gentle, it means you don't exist anymore. Because you only exist when you're making trouble. When you're fighting. That's why when people fight, they feel they're there. They're a being. They're somebody. And you know, you exist. But when you make peace, you just disappear. You vanish. That's why sometimes people like to sort of speak loud or like to be nuisances. Because when they're nuisances and you pay attention to them, then they exist. So if anyone is a nuisance in your cottage, don't pay any attention to them. That really pisses them off. Because they're doing that to say, look at me, I'm here, just now I exist. But when anyone sort of gets so peaceful and quiet, we all just disappear. That's why it's lovely being peaceful, because I like disappearing and vanishing. And being kind as well. Now being kind is, again, we don't have any business. Compassion also makes you disappear. You become selfless. That's why we talk compassionate acts as acts of selflessness. And lastly, being gentle. You're just so gentle, you just like float through the day like a butterfly. You don't sort of barge through the center like an elephant. I know there are some elephants in this meditation retreat. You can tell by the way they open the doors. They're the elephants. Some other people, they're just like these, like ballet dancers. You can't even hear them when they're sort of walking on the floor. They just float in and float out, the gentle people. So that's nothing to do. But this is good, you're subduing and craving the ego. So you just disappear. Ajahn Brahm, can you kindly explain the relationship between the breath and the mind that observes the breath? How they're affecting each other? That's another good question. The mind and the breath. When the mind interferes with the breath, then it sort of agitates the breath. So when you try and hold it, or you want to sort of make it more peaceful, or you want to move from the breath to something else, you're disturbing it. So number one, the mind can interfere with the breath. And when it does, it means the breath becomes less peaceful, less stable. But you know the mind isn't interfering with the breath when the breath becomes very peaceful and very calm. Now, because the breath becomes peaceful and very calm, the mind which watches it has also to become peaceful and calm. It's just that, you know, when the object of your mind is agitating, then you become agitated. When what you're observing is peaceful, you become peaceful. It's just like when I lower my voice and you get very peaceful. When I start talking like this, you see what happens? The object and your mind, they connect together. And this is actually what happens. If you've got a peaceful breath, the mind becomes peaceful. If something agitated out there, you become agitated, the mind becomes agitated. You know, there's a sort of connection between those two. They influence each other. The mind influences the object, and the object influences the mind. That's an important thing to know, because as the mind gets still, the object gets still. As the object gets still, it lets the mind get more still. As the mind gets more still, the object gets more still. So you get this beautiful self-generating, getting more and more and more and more still. But when you get angry and upset, what happens? The object is angry, the mind gets angry, the object out there, you see more anger in it, and you get more angry. And the thing out there, you can see more reasons to get angry, and you get more angry, and the whole thing builds up in a negative way. So the mind and its object do influence one another. So if you put
peace, kindness and gentleness between your mind and its object, everything settles down. If you put control, fear, anger between you and the mental object, then it gets much, much worse. Another way of saying making peace, being kind, being gentle, is actually to use this almost visualization between you and whatever you're experiencing, the breath or thoughts or whatever, and literally put peace, put kindness, put gentleness, put patience in that space between you and whatever you're watching. So when you're watching that through peace, and so you're seeing the peace in the object, you're watching it through kindness, just like looking at something through a tinted glass. It affects what you see. If it's a red tint in the glass, what you see it becomes red. So when you put sort of gentleness between you and the object, what you look at becomes gentle. When you do that between you and whatever you're experiencing, it really affects just the whole experience, and you start to settle down. I like doing that when you're with people. You know, when I'm talking to someone in an interview or whatever, I put peace between me and the person sitting on in the chair opposite me. I put kindness between us. And that's when I look at you with kindness, because I put it in there. And that's actually how I work. I put things in between me and you, so I can see you through this beautiful window of kindness or gentleness. And I do the same with my meditation as well. So it doesn't matter what you experience. Maybe you're really fed up, you know, you've had enough today, you just really want to go to bed, nothing's worked. So with that frustration, put peace and kindness. So it's okay to be frustrated. I make peace with my frustration. I'm kind to it. And I'm gentle. And I'm so patient with my frustration. And then you find it's not frustration anymore. It's my trick to deal with boredom. Whenever you're really bored in this meditation retreat, just have a look at boredom. What does it actually feel like? Where does it come from? Does actually boredom change? Is it always that the same feeling? Or does it sort of get, you know, deeper boredom and lesser boredom? What grades of boredom can you actually see? And actually, where does it actually exist? Is it, how does it manifest in the body? What type of feelings are there when you're really, really bored? And in fact, once you start this investigation into boredom, boredom gets so interesting. You can't be bored anymore. There's too much to look into boredom. So that's my little trick of overcoming boredom. Just finding all these interesting things which are happening in boredom. Is there any comments about what I've said so far? Are you bored? Yeah, go on. Can you explain how I put peace between me and my meditation object? I just imagine it. I just do a visualization. Just like I put this big bundle of peace, and I put it right in front of me. And so I look at you, and look at you through peace. It's nice to do those imaginations. One of the imaginations, which I just sort of remembered, is, I don't know when your birthday is, but it's coming up for Christmas in another sort of 5 or 6 weeks. So in my meditation, sometimes I give myself a gift. What I do, I imagine, you know, this is a little exercise, beginning of meditation. Imagine you've got like an old shoebox. And I think, I know what, I'm going to give myself a beautiful gift. I'm going to give myself the gift of forgiveness. So I put forgiveness. I just imagine like a blob or something. I put it in the shoebox. And I close the lid on the old shoebox. And I imagine I found some very nice wrapping paper. Maybe it's been used before, but I can get the part which hasn't been used. And in my mental exercise, I carefully wrap up that box in this beautiful wrapping paper, and I get out some sticky tape so I can actually stick down the corners. I get a piece of ribbon somewhere or other. I imagine I've got one, and carefully, you know, tie it, you know, with the four sides, and tie a nice little bow. And then I imagine I've got this nice card as well, which I get the card and I write on there, "To me, with love, from me." And I write it on there. And then I imagine that, now I push it aside. I'll just push it aside. And then I imagine just looking around, oh, there's a present there. And I think, I wonder who that's for. And then it's played, but I imagine this. I say,
Ah, it's to me. For me. Isn't that nice? I wonder what's in it. And so slowly, you don't rip it apart. Slowly, you know, you take the little gift card off it, and then you untie, you don't cut the ribbon, you untie it to keep it for another time, and you carefully unwrap the wrapping paper. You know what it's like? You've got a present, I wonder what it is. And then you open it up, but forgiveness. Ah, isn't that sweet and nice? That's what I really wanted for Christmas. And you say, ah, thank you, me. Now, don't laugh at that. That actually works. Its psychological power is because in that whole exercise, you know exactly what you've been doing. For maybe 5 or 10 minutes of that imaginary exercise, you're reinforcing the fact you're giving yourself forgiveness. If you just say, forgive me, that's only not even a second. But for that exercise, you're reinforcing it with all of the getting the shoebox and putting it in there and wrapping it up and putting the sticky tape on and tying the ribbon and writing out a little card and then pushing it aside and imagining you don't really know it and you find it and, oh, isn't this a great surprise? Well, I never expected that. And untying it slowly and taking off the wrapping paper and with excitement opening up, discovering its forgiveness. And all that time, it's a long process. And every moment you're reinforcing the fact you're giving yourself forgiveness. So when you open it up, you can actually receive it. And sometimes instead of putting forgiveness in my box, you put peace in your box. Or, you know, whatever else you need for Christmas. Kindness. Sometimes you can even put, if you're really clever, put Nimitz in the box. Oh, Nimitz! Oh, yeah! Try it out. You know, you'd be surprised how well it works. So that's, you can use imagination, and it's just a mental property which can be very powerful. Ajahn Brahm, what does see the Dhamma mean? Oh, you will find out. Instead of actually explaining it, because sometimes seeing the Dhamma and the understanding the Dhamma are two different things. I already gave the simile of the professor and the going to the restaurant, didn't I? Never mind. I give that so often. I must have given it soon. Okay, here we go. There was a professor of philosophy at the University of West Australia, and he heard that there was a new restaurant opening in Perth. A 5-star restaurant. So he decided to make a booking. He called up and he had to wait for 2 months before he could make a reservation. That's how popular the restaurant was. So he made his reservation. 2 months later he dressed up in a very, very good suit, a nice black bow tie, and he went in a cab to the restaurant, and when he got out and went to the maitre d', he had to show his ID first of all, because it was a very, very fancy restaurant. And they checked his ID and he looked at the list and said, "Sir, there's a reservation for you, come in." So they took him to his table and a waiter came out, you know, the full tails and everything, and gave him the menu on this beautiful thick card. And the menu was written in gold embossed lettering, like calligraphy. The menu was a work of art. And the professor of philosophy said, "Thank you very much." And he proceeded to eat the menu. Then he paid his bill and left, as hungry as when he first got in. Because the professor didn't know the difference between a menu and the food. You get the point? And sometimes seeing the Dhamma is not knowing the Dhamma. It's actually eating the food. That's when you practice and you experience all the teachings, all the stuff which I say, that's just menus. I don't teach Dhamma, I teach menus. But with those menus, hopefully you'll order a few of the dishes which are on offer on this meditation retreat, and you'll taste them. And you taste peace and kindness and gentleness and patience. You taste the beautiful breath. You taste letting go. You taste nimittas, and you taste no will. You taste it and you eat it. and it's delicious, and it's just so good for the heart. And then you've understood. How does one know when one has seen the Dhamma? What happens? Oh, you've got this beautiful full stomach. And you go, oh, there's no doubts anymore. So, you know, you're not hungry anymore for any knowledge because your tummy is full. And you get all this beautiful energy afterwards. So that's what it means by seeing the Dhamma. In a simile. Oh, this is very good. This is, I've said in, I think Nalamara, or I forget where I started seeing this, that the way to address me properly is, dear, your emptiness. Because I know that some people say your holiness or your venerableness or sometimes say reverend. So I like, you know, your emptiness. Isn't that a wonderful say for a monk? And her emptiness is over there. I am interested in talking to the Vietnamese monk who sat for 9 days. One day, would you mind telling me how to contact him? The only way you can contact him is going to deep meditation and contact him on the mental plane. I don't know. Because apparently he wanted to remain anonymous, because when people do this, you don't want to sort of go and tell everybody. Because if you go and tell everybody, you get like be a freak, and you get all these people from universities putting electrodes on your brain to find out what the heck's going on. And, you know, you become like a laboratory rat. And, you know, monks and nuns, we're not rats. So that's why we just don't tell anybody these things and keep it quiet. Can you give some advice on how to deal with the hindrance doubt? Thank you. Like, doubt is a very Western hindrance. They're always asking questions. Just at tea time, we are having this conversation. And one of the monks there, he used to stay with Bhikkhuni Sobhana. And he said, this Bhikkhuni Sobhana, she lives over in the Bhavana Society in Virginia with Bhanteji, Venerable Gunaratana. And she was giving a talk one day, and what was it actually on? It was actually on a story from the Theragata of an executioner. He was a king's executioner 25 centuries ago. And that, you know, he heard the Dhamma, he gave up his job as an executioner, and he actually became a street winner. So he didn't have to take all that bad karma of all the people he killed. And apparently, in the back, this guy was putting up his hand and waving at her. And they said, well, what's your question? He said, that's not right. You can't sort of forgive somebody like that. If he's done all that harm, he's got to get something back in return. I don't agree with this. This is wrong. And he was going on like this. And then, poor old Bhikkhuni Sobhana, apparently, that after a while she just said, well, it's about time we stop now. She got a bit fed up. And on the way out, this guy followed her and said, look, this is not right. And she looked at him and said, are you Jewish? This is the United States, okay? And he said, yeah, I am. He said, I've got a story for you. And he said, and imagine that there was this big, like, football stadium with 100,000 people there. And God came down into that stadium. And then all the Anglicans and the Catholics and the Muslims and the people there just go bowing down and gnashing their teeth and wailing. But the Jewish person will be standing up there saying, God, I've got a question for you. And I followed on with my sort of Jewish joke, which was, there was this Jewish guy, and he'd gone a bit too far. And he was asking too many questions. And so the Jewish elders decided to try him for heresy. So this whole board of Jewish elders, the rabbis and other sort of wise philosophers, 10 of them. And they asked him all these questions, and they decided to take a vote on it. And they decided unanimously that he was a heretic. 10-0, they said, you're a heretic. He said, I appeal to God. God knows I'm not a heretic. And then this big thundering voice came from heaven. He's not a heretic. And the 10 Jewish elders said, well, that's still only 10-1.
Now, those are jokes from Jewish people, so I'm not anti-Semitic at all. But that just shows you just sometimes the doubt. Always asking questions. So instead of asking questions, how about listening for a while? And gathering some data. So what doubt is, always asking. You never get anywhere that way if you don't listen. What do I mean by listening? Just what you were doing a second ago. Quiet, silent, gathering information rather than interrupting the silence with a question, with a doubt. Because every time you make that question, you're interfering with the input of knowledge and wisdom. So what we really need to do is to stop this questioning mind, stop this doubting mind, so we can gather information, to gather the data. And then soon when we have enough data, it'll be quite obvious what the answers are. Just like when we used to do scientific experiments. And these scientists, especially research scientists, would know. You're gathering the data, and maybe you're getting some interesting indications, but you don't make conclusions until all the data is in. If you draw the conclusion too fast, what you happen to do in sort of research is, later on all the research which doesn't agree with the conclusion you made halfway, you sort of you push it aside, and all that research, all the data which justifies or agrees with your conclusion you got halfway, you include. You become biased. So a good research scientist would wait until all the data is in before they make any conclusions whatsoever. Which means you don't doubt, you don't question until the very end, once the data is in. You haven't got the means to question yet. You're just still investigating. So doubt is interrupting the process of investigation. Make sense? Dear friends in the Dhamma, please close the cottage door gently behind you, not allowing it to slam. Now that takes a lot of patience. Actually, we can adjust it so it just does very, very slowly, but I think the adjustment needs to be made quite often, because the more you open it, the adjustment means sometimes it does slam. So all you need to do is you open it, and when you close it, you wait patiently and just stop it with your hand so it makes no noise. So it's a bit of patience, so you can't just run around out. Yes? Okay, so hold the handle and do it very slowly. Now we call this training in meditation burglar training. So when you go into your room, you've got to imagine you're a burglar. So people in the room just will not know you've come in. And if you make any noise whatsoever, then they're going to call the police and you're going to get arrested. You're on parole anyway, so they get arrested, you go to jail for a long, long time. So even burglars have got lots of mindfulness. They can do it, surely you can. So remember, it's burglar training in this retreat. So it's very good, close it so gently. Dear Ajahn, are we allowed to do weeding meditation? If so, where can we find the equipment? Yeah, weed out all of the doubt, weed out all of the ill will and anger and out of your mind. And you already have the four tools for weeding. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, being patient. Weed those things out of your mind, first of all. Because otherwise, it's okay to do some weeding, but you know that it can be just a distraction. You get into this part of the retreat and you get a bit bored, so you're looking for things to do. So I'd actually, there is equipment here for weeding, but I think I'm going to hide it. So you just can't do anything here, except weeding the stuff out of your mind.
We have always thought that attaining jhanas is a very difficult task, and enlightenment is beyond our imagination, but you've made it sound so simple. I wonder if all these attainments can be achieved in jhana groove. That's very nice. Jhana groovy, rather than jhana grove. Or jhana gravy. Because this is the gravy which goes on the top of life, the beautiful meditations. So let's call it jhana gravy meditation center. If so, why many monks and nuns already in seclusion perhaps for many years still have difficulty attaining jhanas and liberation? Oh, because all those monks in seclusion, it's not as nice as jhana grove, is it? Even the nuns were saying that, you know, they say this is like a holiday for them because they get breakfast delivered to them. They don't get that in Dharamsala. So it's a great place. It's the only thing they want to go. They're going to stay here forever. So it is true, when you go on a retreat like this, 9 days, because you know you're not going to be here forever, you actually put a little bit more focus in than monastics do, because we just keep going on and on and on. For us it's like the marathon, for you it's the sprint. And also because, you know, your defilements, you know, your greed and your desires and stuff, you know that in sort of a few days' time you can go watch the telly again, you can have your sex, you can go and eat whatever you want in a few days' time, so it doesn't matter. As for the monks and nuns, and there's no sex in the foreseeable future, forever. No movies, there's no TVs, so, same as ever, just eating whatever's there, never getting the food you like. So that's for us forever. So we're in it for the long haul, and it's a totally different ball game. When you're in it for the long haul, you make these very, very strong foundations, really strong foundations, which means you don't go up so fast. But when you do go up, it's really solid. But you know, for you guys here, you can go up very fast and get maybe even a jhana, but it's hard to get it back again. But it's still worthwhile doing. But you know, for the monks and nuns, it's a strong foundation we make. So we go slow, but once we get up there, ooh, we stay up there. So that's, you know, what happens. Is that true, isn't it, sisters? Yes, very good. Dear Ajahn, oh no, not another one. This sex ones. Is this the same person? Okay, here we go. Dear Ajahn, even if a man manages to cajole, persuade his wife to accept him having sex with another woman because she can't, it may not be a good enough reason for him to break the third precept. Did Ajahn Chah confirm that he told the headmaster it was okay for him to go to the brothel, or did he just say, ah, so, when asked, like the monk who was accused of fathering a child? That was in a story last week or two ago. Actually, Ajahn Chah, she did say, yes, okay, go ahead. We have monogamous laws in Australia, and even Christians and Muslims have vows and laws similar to the Buddhist third precept. But do they keep them? Should we make exceptions to what Buddha has advised for peace and harmony and the benefit of the family, society and the world? Please comment. In the suttas are there examples of the karmic results of men and women who intentionally break the third precept. Now obviously you know that breaking the third precept, you know, this is adultery. The main reason is that you're harming, you're really hurting somebody else. Usually you hurt many people when you commit adultery. In other words, you know, you're hurting your own partner and your children. They lose total faith in you as an example and as a leader for them. Because their kids need those examples. And there you are just being unfaithful to that other parent. So they really get upset at you. And quite rightly. And maybe your parents get ashamed of you, and it causes all sorts of problems to the other woman, you know, other woman or man, you know, who's part of that adultery, and it's their family, and oh, it's just really a mess. That's why, you know, usually you can see, you know, all the movies about adultery or, you know, the book, and you can see just how much problems it gives you. So just, you know, you be honest and be reasonable. You know, usually it just isn't worth it. And for all the people who think you won't get caught. Of course you get caught. Now never underestimate, you know, your partner. They understand what's going on. And I told that to the monks the other day, and we've got this bhikkhuni thing. I said, never underestimate our lay supporters. They know exactly what's going on. You know, they know sort of who the troublemakers are and who the other people are. Because, you know, as monks or as nuns, there's sometimes that it's just too easy to think, oh, you know, we can keep it secret and you won't find out about it. But I've been a monk for such a long time. You know so much about what goes on. Sometimes you just don't tell us, that's all. But you know a huge amount. You understand what's going on. You've got eyes and ears and you're clever. So it's the same if you try and sort of hide something in your family. You just won't be able to do it. People do know. They feel it and they soon find out. So that's one of the first things. If you know you're thinking about committing adultery, it won't be hidden. People find out for sure. So never think that you're going to get away with it. So once you know that, you're going to get caught. It's just hardly worth doing because the problems are just not worth it. And just for a little bit of pleasure, the amount of pain and suffering which you create, just not worth it at all. No, but in that situation of that headmaster, you know, it was out in the open. You know, he didn't sort of hide anything. And it was also, you know, he went to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah gave him permission. Because his wife, you know, it wasn't really, you might call like a wife. You know, she was totally mentally disturbed. He was the only one who could keep her calm and quiet. He would cook and feed her. That was an exceptional case. But unless, you know, your husband or wife is mentally damaged, and you may think they are, but I mean really... clinically so. They just don't do it. So that's really, there is a problem there for most people. And again, menopause is not enough. That's not mental derangement. I notice that no matter how much body sweeping, relaxing I do at the very beginning, there always seems to be a certain amount of tension left somewhere. Or rather in the body. Does one necessarily need to be completely relaxed in the beginning, or is it okay to try escape it by turning onto the breath, which does feel nice? Yeah, you don't have to sort of relax everything. As long as it's relaxed, so you can say, good enough. In other words, you're more relaxed than when you started. And that's enough just to start meditating on the breath. And the breath is very nice. Great! So just go with the breath. When you're with the breath, the rest of the body relaxes pretty quickly anyway. So you don't need to just go through all the parts of the body and do everything before you go onto the breath. After a while, you know, the mind just says, okay, I've had enough now, I want to go onto the breath, and let the mind go onto the breath. That's why I always trust my mind. If this is what it wants to do, off you go. You know how people say and do things that causes problems or hurt others, and then they go on to say they never intended it. Does that mean that they had good intentions? Or somehow it came out the wrong way? Or is it lack of awareness, mindfulness? Or is it our judging mind that looks at others' behaviours as good and bad? Please clarify. Yeah, it is. A lot of times we do things that... Now I've got this, maybe the positive look upon human beings. I think most people have good intentions. Most of the things we do, you know, we really want to sort of create peace and happiness in the world and in our family, but just... Sometimes it's stupidity rather than the, you know, lack of good intentions, or just sometimes we misjudge. So I always like giving people the benefit of the doubt. And I give a huge benefit of the doubt. So I really do feel that people really are intending the best, but sometimes they get it wrong and sometimes they're misunderstood. How many times have you been misunderstood? You've really tried your very best and someone has really totally misunderstood you and they've blamed you and said you were mean and they say you've hurt them. They never meant that at all. So that's happened to you. So obviously, you know, that when you get hurt, they're probably exactly the same. They never intended it, but just it happened. The problem is that, you know, when we are close to one another, when we meet one another, when we're in the same room with one another, so often that there has to be some friction. The closer we are, the more friction there is. So, you know, the people who slamming the doors, they didn't intend that. They didn't think, here she comes. I know this is a time when she just falls asleep. Bang! No one does things like that. Though some people do, but I mean, not many people. And so because of that, it's wonderful to know that people who do these things didn't have any intention. Well, give them the benefit of the doubt. They just made a mistake. So don't get angry at them, upset at them. You know, if you do want to admonish them, and just like they say, just write a little questionnaire. Can people please, you know, be a bit more careful when they close the doors? You know that you're not getting angry at them, because they didn't mean it. It's just, it didn't work out properly. So because of that you can always say that people had good intentions. It came out the wrong way. And so give them a break. And then once you've given other people a break, give yourself a break. Because each one of you has got good intentions, but sometimes you fall asleep when I'm talking. But I'm not kidding, he didn't intend to do that, it just happens. Or sometimes you're late for the sort of the talk or the interview or something. That doesn't matter. So don't feel guilty. In other words, we didn't intend to do anything bad. So if something happens which, you know, you think, oh, I shouldn't have done that, don't feel guilty about it. Your intention was pretty good. So just let it go. Just like you forgive other people. Ajahn, please clarify the place of goals, striving and aspiration. Also, Ajahn Brahm talks in the 90s, mentions sustained application. Do you remember what you meant and how it fits in here? Are the retro talks still applicable? I remember, from the Buddhist Fellowship, Angie came and stayed at our monastery years ago. And she just decided, because she wanted to find out, do a bit of investigation, you know, and sort of how I've changed over the years. She managed to get a cassette tape, you know, one of these old cassettes, plastic, whatever it was. And it was one of my early talks when I first came to Perth about 26 years ago. And she listened to it. She told me afterwards, that was a terrible talk. That was awful. And I said, yeah, wonderful. See, that's why we keep those things, because you do change. You know, you learn from these things. You know, it wasn't born as a teacher. It wasn't born a monk. You know, you just learn as you go along. And it shows you, it gives her faith and confidence that, you know, there's a growth here happening. It's not just somehow you're just born special and then you become a teacher. You know, you actually learn as you go along. And for those of you who've been here a long time, you know, that you actually see these, like, you know, you see these nuns ordain. And then you see them after they ordain, they grow and grow and grow, and then you see them give their first talk. And then you go, wow, this is really inspiring. And you actually see them grow. You actually see this as a process, as a training. Whenever I've gone overseas, you know, I call these my two factories. This is my monk factory over there, and you've got the nun factory over at Dharamsala. You know, you've got this raw material, you churn on the conveyor belt, and after a while you get an ajahn coming out of the end. And there's a great teachers in our monk and nun factories. So that, you know, there are sort of developments as you go along. So the retro talks, some of them are interesting, but, you know, hopefully they're nowhere near as good as the present day talks. You know, you grow and you learn. But the place of the things like aspiration, I say you start with, this is called the four aspirations. You start with aspiration, and then you get expectation, and then you get desperation, and then you get expiration. The four aspirations. It always starts very good. You really aspire for things, and then after a while, you know, you get frustrated. And before you get frustrated, you get desperate, you're really trying hard. How many more days to go? And what the hell have you been doing? Nothing. You start to get desperate. Three more days to go. Two more days to go. One more day to go. How am I going to go back home and tell people what I've been doing? And they come back and they say, well, Ajahn Brahm retreat, did you get jhanas? Well, not really. Close? How close? Well, I was in the present moment for about 1 minute. So sometimes people get very desperate when they set goals for themselves. So, but really that you can put goals, you can put striving, you can put aspiration, but for the right thing. So your aspiration, your goal should be contentment. You should aspire to make peace. Strive to be kind. have a goal of gentleness and patiently go for those goals. And when you get the right goals, the right striving, the right aspirations, then everything gets very peaceful. It works. Get the wrong goals and you just stress yourself out and get frustrated, anger, and you do get desperate, and then the next after desperation you expire. You leave the Buddhist society, you leave the retreat, you run away, you don't ever come back again. So those are the four aspirations. And now the last question. This is not a question, this is a whole sermon. Look at it. Look. Anyway, here we go. So please keep the questions brief. This morning you spoke about letting go. On this subject I'd like to share an experience of mine. Oh, this is not a question, experience. This is good. When I had my wisdom tooth extracted, the dentist told me, once the local anesthesia wears off, I'll be experiencing excruciating pain, then that I should take a powerful narcotic. Oh. True to his words, with the complete wearing off of the local anesthesia, I started to experience agonizing pain. It was so bad that I had to lie down on the bed. Lying on the bed, I focused my total attention on the pain. With deepening attention, I noticed that his pain was not a continuous one, as I was made to believe. It was a series of risings and ceasings, giving the false sense of continuity. Since I've been listening to your Dharma talks almost on a daily basis, you have already brainwashed me, just kidding, with your famous two words, let go. And this came to my mind. I started to pay attention to the pain in terms of its depending arising. I looked at it as just pain. And why should I get involved with it? It is just another feeling. When I continued to contemplate on it for some time, the pain slowly started to ease up, and my mind got completely cut off from the pain. I could only feel the jaws pressing on the cotton swabs. After many hours, and for the next 2 days, I felt this pain more as an annoyance, rather than a pain as such. This experience taught me the power of letting go. Now I know the most potent painkiller, more potent than any narcotic, is letting go. And best of all, unlike in the case of narcotics, it has no bad side effects. But it shares one common side effect with the narcotics, and that is, if you use them, they both are habit-forming. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for this prescription you have given me. From that day, for pain, I prescribed only letting go. And you can be bulk billed by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia for your continuing prescription of the letting go medicine. And it's true, it's so wonderful. The great thing about that is when you know that letting go can actually ease the pain and actually separate and just basically disappear, it takes away one of the greatest fears of human beings. Many people tell me they're not afraid of death, but they're afraid of the pain of dying. Or, you know, women, they love giving birth to babies, but they're afraid of the pain of it. And there's so many things which we're afraid of, the pain of things. And if we know how to deal with pain, even the excruciating pain, well, that's a huge worry off our minds. So when you learn how to let go, well, you're learning what the Buddha said, the two arrows. He said, whenever you have any terrible physical feeling called pain, he said there's two parts of that pain, the two arrows piercing into you. The physical arrow and the mental arrow. He says the physical arrow you can't do much about. It's a toothache, it's an injury, it's an ache, it's a pain, it's a cancer. But the mental part, the mental arrow, you can do a huge amount. You can take that out so easily. So you have the pain and you also have, I don't want the pain. I want to get rid of the pain. I want it to go away. I can't stand it any longer. That's the mental part of the pain. And that is by far the worst. That's 90% or more. So the person who wrote that, they took out the mental arrow. So the physical arrow there, the feeling of the jaws pressing against the cotton swabs, But the mental part of it was taken away. It was just pain, that's all. Which meant it was so easy to endure and no problem whatsoever. And once you've had those experiences, you know exactly what to do with pain. You've got a pain which nothing can get rid of, but your mind can, with beautiful just letting it be. But you've got to be careful. Because some people, they got, say, very bad pain. So what do? They say, let go, let go, let go. I've said that three times, why aren't you going yet? Because that's not letting go. Letting go has to be saying, pain, you can be here for the rest of my life, you can get worse if you want to. It really is letting it go. Then it disappears. If you do letting go as a strategy to try and get rid of the pain, then it doesn't work. You're not letting go. It has to be 100% pure. Any sort of impurity in the medicine, it don't work at all. You know that some of these narcotics and drugs, they're made in Malaysia or India, and they're not the real thing. They've been sort of tampered with, or they've been mostly placebo. So you've got to be very careful there. You know, the real 100% pure letting go drug. It's got a little Buddha stamped on the outside, so you know it's exactly right. So that's the thing which you have to do. So that's the last question for this evening. So those of you who've got a lot of pain, let go. Those of you who got very tired, let go. Those of you who want to go to bed now, just let that feeling go and just sit here. I know it's not going to work. So instead I'll let you go. Good night. Okay. So see you tomorrow. Have a great night. And please remember, don't bang the doors tonight. Hold the handles very slowly and train to be burglars. If you really want any more information about being a burglar, I'll invite some of the guys from Carnot Prison Farm up the road and they can give you even more instructions.